Hi, it's Paul Slackus, Good News Planet. I'm speaking to Glenn Burtnick. Hi, Glenn. How are you?
Great, man.
Great. And with Tony Palagrossi. Hi, Tony. How are you?
Good. How you doing? Good
All
to be
right,
here.
Good. Gem Records, I believe you guys are involved with that or created it. We'll learn about that. We're going to talk about commemorating Woodstock's 50th anniversary, Summer of Love, a two-CD set. Live Love. All right, we love this. Well, give us some background. We're also involved with the Woodstock 50th and looking forward to sharing the good things that you guys are doing.
Well, we started performing a production we put together about close to 10 years ago called The Summer of Love, which was basically a celebration of all this music that I grew up with, and Tony as well, that we grew up with, and it was pretty much the soundtrack of my youth and the rest of my life. I've always listened and loved and admired, you know, the music from the late 60s when things got psychedelic. And so we've been doing this show. We've done it all over the place in the United States, and we decided, actually, I don't even remember how it happened, but it was probably Tony, decided let's record our annual show at the Count Basie Theater in Red Bank. So the entire show was recorded, and like I said, it's a celebration of the 60s, and now by the time we are releasing this record, it is the 50th anniversary of the Woodstock Festival, which is essentially the culmination of the Summer of Love. Technically, the Summer of Love was 1967, and I remember it. I was a teeny bopper, but I remember and love that era. And two years later, it was Woodstock, which was our crowning achievement from that generation. And then, so this all kind of comes together in synchronicity at the same time. Although the album, which is a double album, includes songs that aren't necessarily Woodstock, but from that era. And we do think of the era of Summer of Love as being from 1967 to 1970. I think that's when the world was most beautiful, philosophically anyway. So that's so in a nutshell, that's what this is all about.
So, and I'm from that era, and this is very exciting for me as well. And I don't know, our mutual friend Maureen, give you any background on me, but I had done the 20th anniversary of Woodstock in Times Square. Back in 1989. I didn't go to Woodstock. I didn't even know about Woodstock. I just saw a lot of cars on 684 going across to Woodstock area. We were saying, what's going on here? We were kind of, I was the president of the class with a tie and jacket, you know, I was like a real nerd. And so even though I was a musician, but I didn't know about it. I wasn't cool. I wasn't hip. In any case, but I've been playing, you know, all the good kind of music most of my life. I think, what do you think? Did you guys go to Woodstock? I'll ask you that.
I did not.
Actually, I did.
Ah, okay. And so how did you know about it? Let me ask you that, and then we'll talk more about your CD set and stuff.
Well, first of all, I was, like Glenn, I was a musician, a young musician. I guess I was 14 going on 15. And so a lot of the artists that were what we heard were playing, I was familiar with. But essentially, I got to go because a family, friends of my parents, had a nephew who was going to be a pre-med student at Rutgers, and he knew about it. And he was also the guy who turned me on, who got me high for the first time when I was 13 years old. But he was going to be.
We don't even have to say bleep bleep anymore.
Right, right. Thank God. Thank God. Thank God.
We'll smoke to that.
It only took 100 years, you know. 2 years. But he was going to be pre-med, and he, you know, he was going, and he was 18 or 19. He was 18, I guess. And he basically approached my mother and said, you know, I'd like to take Tony to this. And what I kind of framed it as a camp out sing-along, because my mother knew what that was. And quite frankly, none of us really knew what this was going to be, you know. We just knew bands were playing, and we wanted to go. So she let me go, and we ended up going up early, kind of like that movie. What was the name of that film?
Was it Taking Woodstock?
Taking Woodstock, right, exactly. Yeah. So we got up there, you know, 2 or 3 days early. And so we didn't hit a lot of the problems that people hit when they were coming up later. And it was kind of interesting to be in that town prior to the, you know, 3 days prior to the event and see the whole thing just, you know, pile in and build up and turn into what it turned into. But, you know, obviously my mother was horrified, and she probably aged 20 years during those 6 days, 7 days.
When she saw it on the news, right?
Yeah, she saw it on the news. And, you know, of course, the big thing was when, you know, Governor Rockefeller declared a state of emergency and was going to send in the National Guard. Now, we didn't really know that. It was rumored. But my mother was watching all of this. And, you know, obviously there were no cell phones. And, you know, the few phones that were there were either not working or, you know, there were lines. It was like, you know, the hell with that. Plus, I was tripping, so the last thing I was thinking about was calling him. So that was kind of my experience. And then we stayed afterwards. We actually helped clean up, and it was amazing. You know, just saw a whole world that, you know, was kind of hoping existed, and then I found out that it kind of did exist. It was great. So.
Now, you both are actually great musicians as well, right? I mean, you've performed in great groups.
Well, I think there's one great musician on the phone here. I'm just a...
Oh, no.
You're talking about me? Who are you talking about?
Tony was in...
How'd you know?
In addition to other groups, Tony, who plays trumpet, was in the Asbury Jukes and probably in their most important era. And then I met him when we were together in a band called La Bamba and the Hubcaps. So yes, we are both musicians, is the answer to that.
Yeah, no, you're really very impressive backgrounds and careers. So what brought you to, say, now, I mean, you put out other records over the years as a group. So what? Tell me, who is Gem Records?
A guy named Marty Scott. Mm-hmm. He has a record label that I remember as a kid in the 70s, I would buy lots of vinyl, which I still play.
Weren't they known for importing?
Yeah, Marty had a company. Well, it was two different arms of the same label. One was called Passport, which was importing records, and I bought. I, you know, invested deeply at that time in all of these albums that weren't released in the United States that were released in Europe, and that was Marty Scott's Passport Records, which was affiliated with Gem Records. And so then, because of that, because I became enamored with that label, it wasn't much of a label. It was a sticker that went on, you know, this is a Passport record distributed by Gem. And then... So I would start to pick up Gem Records because, well, they're part of the Cool Guy Club, you know. So I had known about Marty, or at least his label, you know, since the 70s. And lo and behold, I met him on another project that Tony and I are involved in, a group called The Weaklings. Marty reached out to me and he says, I'm hearing great things about this band. Would you be interested in releasing a record? So, and we have a couple of albums out, the Weaklings do, on Gem Records. And then it led to this, where Tony and I have this very successful theatrical presentation, The Summer of Love. And Marty said, well, why don't we you know, why don't we release a record of that show?
Yeah, it was, you know, it was something that I always wanted to do. I'd you know, been in the studio on and off with different people that I'd worked with as a player. And the studio always intrigued me, and making, you know, the making of a record always intrigued me. I worked with, you know, different producers, and I thought, obviously, I thought some were good, and I thought some weren't all that good. And I think I wanted to kind of capture kind of the magnificence of this show that Glenn and I put together. Because, I mean, there were nights that it was absolutely brilliant. And usually when we were playing the Count Basie Theater, we were all in our best behavior and playing really well. And I just decided that, well, what the hell, let's just record it. Last year was the eighth year that we had done it. And we recorded it, and the band and the cast was really on that night. It was really a brilliant show. And initially, it was just going to be something that we were going to sell at gigs as a merch item. And then, as Glenn was saying, Marty, who had a relationship with the Weaklings, basically said, well, you know, how about I kind of like to put this out on Gem. And it sounded like a kind of a cool thing to be on a label with the 60s project, which was all about album rock. And that's how the double album kind of happened, because it was just an iconic album type of that era. And we thought that, in keeping with the theme, that it would be a cool thing to release a double album.
It is a format. You're absolutely right. Yeah. It is a format that, you know, harkens back to the 60s and 70s. And I'm just reminded while we're talking about this that I've been involved in a lot of albums, as has Tony, but this is the first time I've ever put out a double album, so this is a landmark in my life too.
And you know, we were blessed with great performances that night, and I think if nothing else, the double album really captures the essence of the show, and which is really what I wanted to do as a producer of the record, and I think it did that. In spades. I mean, everybody was great that night, and it was a pleasure to listen to it over and over and over and over.
Well, I'll be honest. I apologize. I haven't listened to it yet, but I'm sure I will, because I'm so involved with my own Woodstock Forever Peace, Love, and Hope outreach. I'm finishing a movie. I'm going to share some stuff just because maybe that we can do some things together and.
Cool.
Because I sense we're all on the same page, and I'm recording. So, oh, also what we're saying, we're all enamored with that time. We're enamored with it because I think in our souls we feel that I spent 2 years trying to do Woodstock in 1989 in my life with Richie Havens. I was given Central Park, the Great Lawn. I was given PBS. I'm a TV production guy. Schlepper to a producer, okay? CBS, PBS, 150 network shows. And so some involvement, you know, there were all these big productions, and I had a job amongst them. And so I wanted to do Woodstock in Central Park, and they gave me the Great Lawn. He gave me a yellow light, Mr. Henry Stern. And then PBS, where I had come from, said they would broadcast it. If I could raise $700,000, okay, is what I needed to do this, not for PBS, but to do an event in the Great Lawn. In those days, you needed $700,000 for security and everything, because that's just the way it is. And then they had that big problem with Diane Ross one time when they started raining. So they weren't even going to do anything. But somehow that healed, and they were going to allow it. I wasn't able to raise the money. I ended up doing something in Times Square. I brought a group of people, Jumla Sultan, down from a group from Woodstock, Bethel, and we did some ceremony in Times Square, which is actually where I do my peace day. I'm involved with the International Day of Peace, September 21st. And so I am possessed with wanting to do a concert at the Great Lawn here in Manhattan, okay, with Peace, Love, and Hope as the thing. So I'm finishing a movie with the footage from that time, as well as adding similarly concept that you have with the kinds of music. So, but I've made it up to today's day, and I'm doing it even with my grandkids. So I have some of the kids' programs from the Loud family, and then I have Lady Gaga, and I'm putting all these pieces together to make this movie, okay? But I really want to do a big event, and I have a hold for Peace Day on the Great Lawn. But at Woodstock 50th has been canceled. You're aware of that, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Big concert, okay? And I was hoping that I could give them an opportunity with our Peace Day to switch from that time Woodstock to maybe everybody working together for peace, because 193 countries have agreed to the International Day of Peace. So I'm bringing this up just to give you some background on this. I'm sorry if you're interviewing, but I wanted to spend a moment as well. I see you guys are promoting. Here's my thought. I'm just wondering. August 15th and August 16th, you guys are performing, and in Morristown and then Somerville, right, with your show, right?
Right.
Did you ever go to make TV show out of it? And can you?
What
and
was that?
You don't want to talk about it now. Did you ever make a TV show, live broadcast to the world, in honor of Woodstock?
No, we haven't.
No, we haven't. Yeah.
Well, maybe after this call, maybe we could talk about it and see if there's any interest. I just wonder about that because, especially now with Woodstock 50th being, you know, canceled, you know, they put $30 million into it or so, Bosley.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Lang is saying that he's going to resurrect it and he has people and blah, blah, blah.
Yes. Okay. Well, whether he does or doesn't, the important thing is what evolved out of that time that you two were so respectful of and lovingly of, you know, the more love we share in more media and more of the world, the better off we all are, right?
For sure.
So let them do what they're doing. You guys are doing what you're doing. Let's maybe talk about something here. So it was a thought that I had.
Cool.
Sorry to interrupt, but I'm so connected in it right now. Myself.
Sure.
What is it about this business that is very addictive? What do you guys say?
Well, it's I woke up today and with the thought that I've lived a charmed life. I feel like we have lived through the finest years of our culture with the best music and the best art, even though there's been great art before us and all. But I feel like I'm very fortunate to have lived in this era that I've lived through. And on top of just the time I'm living, the work I've done, I've been able to, you know, make a living creating music. So I feel very fortunate. And the music that we've been involved in is rich. You know, American music is a rich place and when we do this Summer of Love show, you know, we're touching on, you know, we've got bits of Janis Joplin from Texas, and we have, you know, Otis Redding. You know, we're drawing Sly Stone from the Bay Area. We're drawing from within the American landscape when it all came together. You know, in the 60s, the top 10 records used to be the most diverse selection of music. You'd have, you know, the theme from Born Free would be on the same chart as Gary U.S. Bond's Quarter to Three. I mean, it's like, it's unthinkable, like the theme from Exodus.
Wow. Great.
Yeah, with the singing nun, you know, I mean, it's beautiful. It was a beautiful time. Yeah, Frank Sinatra, Louis Armstrong. I mean, it was
Louis Armstrong,
ridiculous, you know.
Hello, Dolly. You know.
Yeah, yeah. Bing Crosby. You know, it's
so
it's incredible.
Yeah,
and
what
I
an
remember
observation.
This shit, you know.
Yeah.
And here we are, and so you know, to look back on that era, and you know, celebrate it with a show, a live show that we put out a double CD is, you know, what a treat. What a treat to have lived through it and to contribute to the more peace and joy and love and all of the stuff that we were going for in the late 60s.
I think one of the things that we tried to do when we put this show together was be that conduit where all of the moments of the music that we embraced were, to the best of our ability, were highlighted at some point in the show, which makes for a long show at times, very long show.
Yeah.
Sorry.
But
I got, you know, I got 28 hours for my movie.
I hear you. I feel your pain.
Stressed. Yeah, okay.
But, the reality was, there were two things that were brought two moments, not moments, but two vendors, two outlets that brought the culture together and gave it kind of a common language. One was Top 40 Radio, mm-hmm. and the other one was the Ed Sullivan Show.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I was born in 1954, so when the Beatles played Ed Sullivan in 1964, I was 10 years old, and I saw the Beatles with, 73 or 75 million, whatever it was, other Americans. Now, this is at a time probably when the population of the United States was about 230 million.
Mm-hmm.
So literally one-third of all of the people in the country saw the same damn thing. And Top 40 Radio was very much the same thing. I mean, as Glenn said, you'd hear Frank Sinatra 1 minute, you'd hear Jimi Hendrix the next, you'd hear Joan Baez, you'd hear the Flying Nuns, and the singing nuns.
They were flying.
Right, they were flying, I'm sure, hopefully. Because they weren't doing anything else, but...
they were good,
but you never know, right? But there was this common language that a big chunk of the culture knew, which is so much different than today, where even the biggest musical forms or art forms or books or anything that the culture digests in some fashion, it, regardless of how big it appears, they're all niche markets now. Because the market is just so, first of all, it's a worldwide market now, easily accessible by anybody who has a cell phone or a computer. And in this country, there aren't 230 million people anymore. There are 330 million people. Spanish is a second language now. I mean, and Spanish music is this huge music in our country that if you're not Latin, if you're not Spanish, if you're not from South America, the Caribbean or Mexico, or, you probably don't know very much about it, and yet some of those artists, many of those artists come to the States and they're playing arenas all over the country, so all of these things that, at one point everyone knew about that were huge are still huge, but very few people comparatively know about them in terms of the entire breadth and length of our country and the world. So what I think our show tries to do is encapsulate that common language that our generation had and present it to our audiences. So far, the response has been pretty damn good.
Great. Okay. Let me ask two last questions and thank you guys for sharing, Live Love. And we have all the links and we'll send people.
Well, it can be Live Love or Live Love, however you see it.
Live, love, live, love, live, love, live, love. Yeah, you got it. All right, so each of you, if you don't mind, we're, as I mentioned, involved with the International Day of Peace, World Peace, and I've asked that lots of people, what does peace mean to them? Do you guys, would you care sharing, maybe say your name first, and then what does peace mean to you guys?
Well, this is Glenn Burtnick, and peace to me means the acceptance and the tolerance of everyone else's space, beliefs, cultures, and the appreciation of our differences on this lovely planet.
Okay. Beautiful.
Well, that's, yeah, I mean, I don't know how much I can add to that. You know, there's different kinds of peace. There's external peace. There's internal peace. There's peace with the beyond, being comfortable with that. I think peace has to do with internal and external comfort and calmness and tranquility, emotional tranquility and social tranquility and racial tranquility and gender tranquility and acceptance. And hopefully through this very turbulent time, and to me that the turbulence kind of reminds me of the 60s in many ways, the 60s and the 70s here in this country. I feel, and I'm being optimistic, and I will be an optimist, hopefully, in this regard till I pass on to the next reality. But I believe that out of all of this turmoil, we're going to achieve a level of peace, hopefully, that is beyond anything we've experienced before. So that's my hope and my dream, and I think sometimes peace can only be achieved through strife, and we're definitely in a period of turmoil and strife right now, and which is, I think, a perfect time for a show like The Summer of Love and an album like Live Love or Live Love coming out. And hopefully that message is something we can put out there and people can digest and you know, and use it in their own lives and give it to other people.
Fantastic. Last question, because we do have a channel for love. And I ask people, what does love mean to each one of you guys? Love.
Oof.
Torture
to define love. Oof. That's huge.
Yes, it is.
Love is many things and many people. Essentially, though, I think it is this extra spiritual feeling, you know, that gets your dopamine going, you know, that comes from natural things like family or significant others or music and art. I love, there are pieces of music that I sincerely love as much as I love my children, you know. So I think it's this feeling, it's a high that your body, or my body anyway, you know, experiences through something that's it's almost invisible. You know, why do, and love is invisible, really. Why do I love my wife so much? You know, like, what is love? You know, can you see it? No, but you should certainly feel it.
Yeah. I think love, I think love is something that transcends the body, the physical reality. I think it's a, well, what did Plato say? It was a desire for beauty. It's a, you know, it's a desire for the best in our nature, in our world, in our relationships, in our art. And it's also the desire to give that to someone else. I guess that's what love means to me.
I want to paraphrase something. The Supreme Court, some justice on the Supreme Court once said, "I can't define pornography, but I know it when I see it." And so I want to paraphrase that. I want to paraphrase that with, "I can't define love, but I know it when I feel it."
Guys, you two are the best.
We're musicians, do we?
But I'm pumped. Yeah, I've done 1,000 of them. What an ending.
Yeah.
Cool.
You guys are brothers.
You're a special dude. All right, man. Thank you very much. And we'll do what we can to help promote it. And let's speak after.
Thanks much.
See if we can do some things together. All right. Thank you so much.